Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 1st of February, Anno Domini 2014. And you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, once again, I have to re-sign in to my own Hangout. I hate this. And I appear to be in here twice now. That's just freaking excellent.
You're such a magnanimous personality.
I don't understand this at all. But we're here to bring you news, views, blah, blah, blah. Okay, get it. Here's the news. Yahoo said it is resetting passwords for some of its email users after discovering a coordinated effort to compromise accounts. Attackers behind the cracking campaign used usernames and passwords that were probably collected from a compromised database belonging to an unidentified third party, according to Jay Rossiter, Yahoo's senior vice president of platforms and personalization products, who wrote an advisory which was published on Thursday. A large percentage of people use the same password to protect multiple internet accounts, a practice that allows attackers holding credentials taken from one site to compromise accounts on other sites. There's no evidence the passwords used in the attack came from Yahoo systems. Our ongoing investigation shows that malicious computer software used the list of usernames and passwords to access Yahoo Mail accounts, Rossiter wrote. The information sought in the attack seems to be names and email addresses from the affected accounts' most recent sent emails. Yahoo administrators are resetting passwords for all affected accounts. Administrators are also using second sign-in verification to let users resecure their accounts. Affected users will be prompted to change their password. They may also receive an email notification or a text message for accounts that are associated with a mobile phone number. World of Warcraft, vBulletin, MacRumors, and Adobe are only a tiny sampling of the sites recently hit by attacks that exposed password data. There are many more attacks that go unreported or that can't be linked to a particular site or service. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, Yahoo Mail gets hacked. And your choices are, I can't remember yet another password, I can't remember my Yahoo password, they'll never guess 123456, and wait, Yahoo still has email? So far, predictably, most of you are voting for Yahoo. Wait, Yahoo still has email. So you can vote at soundbites.org. And of course, you'll have more to say about this. I know you will, because you are who you are. And so if you go down on the lower, on the right-hand column about halfway-ish down, you'll see fascinating stuff under that, the forums, and under that, under Forum 1 Feb 14, Yahoo Mail gets hacked. And of course, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Before we go to the phones, let's talk a minute about passwords. You need to make sure yours are all different. I don't care how stupid you want to pretend you are, you're not stupid. I know that. You can remember more than one password. If you can't, there's programs like LastPass and KeePassX and several other password vaults
and there's,
that will remember them for you.
The keychain utility built into the Mac already.
And into Windows and into Linux. Well, not into Windows, but into Linux. That will do the same thing. There's also the fact that many browsers will remember your password for you.
And generate random passwords that you can't remember, which means the bad guys can't guess.
Right, exactly. So all of those things mean that you can have secure passwords on every one of your machines. All you have to do is enable it. All right, now to the phone.
I'll say that there was a study. I'll post a link if I can find it. The most common passwords in 2013. And password has been usurped as the number one password. It's now number two. The number one password for 2013 was 123456.
Which is what I used. Yeah. In. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. All right. Okay, now here's the other interesting thing. I do not understand Google Hangouts. I was in the Google Hangout and it kicked me out, brought me back in. There were two of me. Now there's just one of me again. So I go to put up my name again, yeah. Right?
And you're already there?
No. The preset, which I have set every freaking week since this started, is gone.
And that's probably one of the most frustrating things with computers is you didn't change anything, but the computer is doing something different.
Right. Okay, so I'm setting my name in the thing. I am now going to change the color to green because I just happen to like green. And I'm going to save it as a preset, which I've done only about 2,000 or 3,000 times.
So all this preset stuff is supposed to make it easier to get back in again, right?
That's the theory.
That's the theory.
Oh, I see. And you can't now. It's saved and it's on, and that is what it is. Okay.
Three
now
in practice.
To the phones. Our first caller is Linda from Greece, New York. Welcome, Linda. What's up?
Hi, guys. Long time since I talked to you.
I know. What's up?
Okay, I got a question. Does Dave still have his computer shop?
You'd have to ask Dave that. I think it's on hiatus at the moment, but I don't know that.
Oh, okay. No, the reason why I was asking was I went to his shop, and it was closed and looked like there was nothing in there.
Well, maybe then. I believe it is on hiatus at the moment.
Yeah, he has semi-retired from computer repair business himself.
Yeah, but Kathy was there, and Dan Deary was there, but I don't see either one of those.
Right. I guess not anymore then. I apologize. Dave is not here this week. You would have to ask him.
Okay. Another question. I saw on Twitter where Windows 8.1 is going to get rid of the tiles. What does that mean?
The tiles, actually I have a story about this for later. The tiles are those little squares that you see when Windows 8 first comes up. That you can, if you're on a touch device, you can swipe back and forth. People hate it. Hate.
With a burning passion, they hate these things.
But that's what makes it different from Windows and iOS on the phone. And Microsoft is making their phones and their desktops look the same.
And that's what people hate.
Yeah.
They hate the fact that it's an interface designed for touch, and they're putting it on machines that don't have touch interfaces.
Uh-huh.
You know, that have keyboards. And
right.
Using the Tile interface, which used to be called Metro and is apparently now called the Tile interface.
The modern, because Metro was someone else's trademark. And,
right.
Yeah.
It's the modern interface, I guess. Apparently, and I agree with this, it's impossible to use.
Tell me about it.
Well, and that's the thing. And then the theory is... 8.1 is supposed to make it, well, they've gone back and forth between making it a choice and making it gone.
Because if people who started with Windows 8 probably don't know any better, don't know any different, and it works fine. Yeah.
Well, and I believe what they're saying is that right now, the modern interface is mandatory, is the choice, but in 8.1, it will be turned off by default, and if you want it, you can turn it back on.
Okay, the reason why I'm asking is my Windows 7 laptop bit the dust. So I'm forced to get a laptop. Tell me, what do you think about this? It's got an A10 processor, 8 gigs of memory, and 1 terabyte hard drive. What do you think of that?
In a laptop?
Yeah.
That's a lot of laptop.
What kind of processor was it?
An A10?
A10, yeah.
That's a mobile processor, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You don't want a mobile processor in a laptop.
Well, it means it's lower power.
Lower power,
the
yeah.
The battery will last longer.
Those are the processors that usually go into phones.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a 15.6 inch. Because I saw the commercial on QVC. It was an A10, 8 gigs of memory, or whatever you call it. And then it's got 1 terabyte hard drive.
Yeah, that's pretty good in laptops. In fact, in our store, we were trying to replenish our 500 gig hard drives that we put in laptops. Apparently, not many companies are making 500 gigs anymore. A terabyte is now the smallest hard drive.
Yeah, you can't buy less anymore.
Yeah.
If it's a quad core processor,
it is.
Will it be the fastest machine you've ever owned? Unlikely. But then, so what? You know?
Yeah, but if it gets your web browsing and gets your email, that's fine.
If it's the A10 4600M, it's actually faster than an i5, but not as fast as an i7.
Yeah,
so it's going to be fine. It's going to be more than fine.
Okay. So, I know Dave doesn't like me to call back 2 weeks in a row, but how do I find out if Dave has closed his shop or anything? Because if I call next week, Dave's going to say, well, you called last week.
I know. Well, you'll have to call. You can email him, dave@soundbites.org, that will get to him, and then you can talk to him directly that way.
Okay. But when I'm getting my new laptop at the beginning of at the middle of February, so I will have a choice then? Whether I use the tiles or not?
Well, if 8.1 is out by then, yes.
Okay. What do you think? One more thing, and then I'll go. What do you think of a classic shell?
Well, that's the traditional Windows desktop that we're all used to, and very similar to the Mac desktop. Microsoft copied it from Mac. Well,
so
and Apple copied it from Xerox.
Right.
But yeah, well, that's what everyone's used to, and so the whole tile interface is just so different from the classic desktop we're used to that people don't like change. So that's why there already are utilities to let you get rid of that modern interface on Windows 8.0 even and go back to the desktop as your default interface.
Yeah, okay, yeah, because I know my friend's got the classic shell and I go, oh, that's Windows 7. She says, no, it's Windows 8. I went, oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes your Windows 8 look like Windows 7, which Microsoft doesn't want to happen because they want to sell a lot more Windows 8 machines.
Right.
Well, they're not doing that.
Yep.
And I heard there's a Windows 9 now?
No, there is not a Windows 9 now. There will be a Windows 9 at some future point. What they have right now is Windows 8. 8.1 is coming, and they're working on 9.
Ah, so I hope that's a lot better.
If it follows their odd numbered releases, then it probably will be.
Right.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Bye.
It's interesting with Windows is that every other version has been so different, people haven't liked it.
Right.
The big problem with Vista is there was no drivers in it, so everyone didn't like it and skipped it.
Right.
And then 7 was good. 8 is too different. 9, what's going to happen with 9? Are they going to go back and admit that they were wrong and go back to the desktop interface? It's hard to see Microsoft admitting they were wrong.
Well, right.
Or are they going to make it now an option?
Well, and I think they kind of have to because, again, they're trying to make everything the same, having a single code base. I get all that. That's cool. The problem really is that many people still have standard non-touch desktops and laptops with keyboards, and the modern interface with a keyboard and no touch is crap.
Yep. And more computers are getting touch interfaces, but until they all do, it just doesn't work well.
So you at least have to have the choice.
Yeah.
All right. Back.
Well, I was saying, on the Mac side, there have been similar concerns because the Mac OS has added several features. There's the launch pad that makes your Mac look like an iPad, and a lot of the code base is the same underneath. So there's been a lot of concern on the Mac side that our Mac OS is going to go away and become iOS. Tim Cook said at a conference a few days ago that no, that will not be happening, and so we don't have to worry about that.
Well, that's nice.
Until they change their mind.
On the Linux side, of course, for decades we've been able to pick any interface we want.
Yeah,
we want.
Well, and that wasn't there a new Ubuntu that everyone hated?
Well, Ubuntu now has Unity,
yeah,
which everybody hated. But if you don't like it, you can put GNOME or KDE or XFCE or XCAE XD. Wait, XFD. XDE, XFCE. There's hundreds of them. And they all have odd names.
And it's, people don't like it. Same thing in Windows and Mac. People don't like it because it's different.
Right.
If you start with the different, you don't know that it's different and it's fine.
Right. The one I prefer is XFCE, although I am using Mint, which uses GNOME, so that's kind of nice. But, you know, they're all a little different. They're all a little the same, and you just pick the one you like and you go. Our next caller, Tom from Penfield, New York. Welcome, Tom. What's up?
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. I've got a HP laptop I got 4 years ago. At the time I got it, it had Windows 7 Home Premium on it. So I partitioned it, and I use Ubuntu most of the time since then.
Yep.
Well, my hard drive failed about a month ago, so I got another hard drive, the same make and model, and put it in. And then on my wife's MacBook, I burned a Ubuntu DVD, and I put that on that hard drive. So I got up and running, and I got everything back from Jungle Disk. So I was pretty happy with that. The only thing I missed out on, I didn't realize, I use Seahorse for my password protector.
Right.
And I didn't realize I didn't have the right folder. I had one folder up on Jungle Disk, but the other folder, it's GNOME 2 folder, is the one that actually holds the files for all my passwords. So anyways, I got almost everything back, but I still wanted to get Windows 7 back if I could. And also at the time, I didn't know how to get my passwords back. So I got the old drive, and I took the PCB off of it, sent it to a place in Canada. They transferred the ROM to the remanufactured or the, you know, the other board, sent it back. And I got that back, put it in an external case, plugged it in the USB, and I got that to work so I can boot up the old Ubuntu.
Wow.
I got my passwords back. But the only thing I can't do that I could do before is I can't get into Windows 7. When I try to boot up into Windows 7, it sends me into HP. It's a maintenance or whatever. It doesn't like the fact I think that now I've got an external hard drive.
Okay, two things.
With 7 on it. Yeah.
Two things, Tom. When you got your new hard drive, did you install Windows on it?
No, I didn't do that. I have the old repair disk that I made back in 2009, so
right.
I do have that. But you know, I don't have the Windows 7 original disk. You don't get that anymore, right?
Right. You can buy it. You can generally buy it, but that right.
Yeah.
What I think may have happened is most PC laptops now come with two partitions already on the drive. Your main, C boot partition, and then the recovery partition. And so it sounds like it's booting the recovery partition, not the main partition.
Well, it sounds like there isn't a main partition.
I get a choice. I get a choice when it first comes up. I get Windows 7, and then I think I've got two recovery lines that come up. I can't remember what they're called.
Right.
But I've tried everything, and nothing rings up. The actual it goes into Windows 7. It tries to, but then it goes into a mode that it's looking for repair or replace or something. So I never actually get into Windows 7.
Well, okay, so is it trying to boot Windows 7 and then boots the recovery, or is it only booting the recovery?
It takes me to like a HP...
But did it try to boot into Windows 7?
Have I tried? Yeah.
The normal Windows 7.
All three of them.
No, not you.
Windows
it.
7 and then the two recovery modes.
No, I'm sorry, Tom. Tom,
yeah.
Stop.
Yeah.
Please listen to the question.
Okay.
When you try to go into Windows 7, does it immediately go to the recovery, or does it try to go into Windows 7 first, fail, and then go into the recovery?
It brings up the Windows 7, I guess, introduction screen, I'd call it, but it never goes to my password.
Okay.
Okay,
so it's trying to boot into Windows.
Yeah.
Can't.
Right.
And then goes to the repair disk. Have you tried putting in the repair disk?
Yeah.
And letting it repair.
It doesn't seem to actually, it'll spin, but really nothing comes of it. It kind of goes back into the HP mode again where it's looking to repair something.
Try letting it repair.
What happens if you say repair?
It never goes that far. It just kind of cycles back again.
So both of the partitions on the internal drive have mucked up.
What it sounds like is that when you got the original disc, set up before you put Ubuntu in it, did you boot Windows and did it work?
Well, you're talking 4 years ago or now?
Now, when you got that second drive put in.
Yeah, I never put it in the computer. It's in an external case.
Oh, so you're still booting, but you're booting from it.
Yeah, well, I'm booting. Well, at normal startup, I'm booting from the new drive that's in my computer. I've got my old drive.
I don't care about the old drive
case right now.
The new drive. When you put the new drive in your computer, it's actually in the computer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that new drive. Did it ever boot Windows before you put Ubuntu on it?
No, it was a new drive that I bought. It was a brand new drive, and the only thing I put on it was Ubuntu. I didn't have Windows 7 to put on it. And at this point, where I am is I use Ubuntu 99% of the time.
Right.
I don't have to get into Windows very often. It'd just be nice if I could, because there's a couple things like a Garmin update, and if I do my taxes on TurboTax, it likes to have Windows, and also I use iTunes once in a while in Windows, but so seldom. It's just a nicety for me to be able to go in and boot from an external drive now to get back into Windows. But it's not seeing something, or something not set up right.
Well, what it sounds like is that external drive is, in fact, physically damaged.
The boot records are not.
The boot records are bad, and that's why you had to replace it to begin with. Making it external isn't going to help.
Okay, it was dead as a hammer before. I put the new.
All right, Tom, we got to take a break. I'm sorry, we got to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes, Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 25 minutes after the hour, Sound Bites on member supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 28 minutes after the hour, we've still got Tom on the line. Tom, let me ask you a question here. You still there? Tom?
Yeah.
Tom?
I'm here.
Yep.
Excellent. Let me ask you a question, because I think we've been talking at cross purposes. You have two drives. The new one is internal. The old one is external.
Yeah, the one internal just has Ubuntu on it.
Okay, so when you boot that one up, your only choice is Ubuntu.
Right.
Okay.
I just plugged my external drive in, and I'm at the loader right now, and I've got Windows 7 loader, and I've got Windows Recovery Environment SDA2, and Windows Recovery Environment SDA3. So I can boot into any three of those.
But when you do, what happens?
Well, I'll do it right now. I'll boot into Windows 7.
I can't see it, so that doesn't help me. Just tell me what happens when you boot into each one.
It goes launch, repair, startup repair, recommended, or start Windows normally.
And when you say start Windows normally, what happens?
It says starting Windows. And then we have to wait.
Yeah, we really can't wait. Have you done this before? What happens?
Well, it's coming up now, and it went back to Grub again. So I got
radio.
The Windows 7 loader, and I got the same place I was.
Okay, so what's happened is that external drive is badly damaged.
Okay,
and it will likely never reboot until you possibly. If it's only the operating system image that's damaged, you might be able to repair to just put Windows on it. Just put Windows on
it. Reinstall Windows from scratch.
Right, on that drive.
Okay. What I've got is a recovery disk, so I'd have to call HP and maybe have them send me Windows 7.
Right, you'd have to call HP with your serial number and buy a recovery disk. They used to be cheap. I don't know if they still are.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to know, really, because if that's the case, I mean, I got everything I want here, really, except for that.
Okay.
So if that's the case, then I'll get in touch with them and see if I can do that.
Right, and then you can use Ubuntu most of the time, and then once in a while, plug that external in, go for it.
Yep. Yep. Okay,
all right.
Answered my question.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Now, I have seen lists. I'm Now, this one's PC World magazine, so I trust it a little bit. Apparently, if you have your Windows 7 product key, which should be a sticker on your computer somewhere, Microsoft makes available downloaded Windows 7 install disks. So you download an image and burn it to your own disk.
Right.
And I can post this link from PC World. I kind of trust that PC World wouldn't tell you how to do something illegal.
And I have actually done that with Microsoft Office for the Mac.
Right.
When you go to the site, it asks you for your serial number, checks to make sure it's never been used before, or, you know, checks to see that it's not online now or something.
Right.
Or at least that it's legit. And then lets you download it, and then you have to use exactly that same serial number.
Right.
I found out when I mistyped it.
Yep.
To do the install. So that should work.
Yeah, because so many computers these days don't come with optical drives anymore. Apple started that trend a couple of years ago, and now Apple's only got one lone model that still has an optical drive in it. You can get external drives if you want. But even PC models now are not including optical drives, so there's no place to put in a CD because so much of everything is downloadable now.
Yep.
And so this link from PC World, it points to Microsoft's digital content provider, Digital River, where you download the digital version of the disk, and then you burn it to your own disk, or flash drive is even better, and install, and you must have a valid product key for that, and that's usually a sticker. Now, I've seen a lot of laptops will put the sticker on the bottom of the laptop,
right,
and then over the years it rubs off.
Right. Well, the theory is when you buy a new machine, that serial number is so important, you should write it down somewhere and keep it safe.
Right.
Theoretically.
Just like you should have kept the disks that computers right. used to come with. There was an HP Tower model I loved because it had a disk holder on the top of the tower.
Yep.
You open the door and you put your disks in there. And,
I remember that.
Yep. And then you don't lose them.
Yep. I have to tell you, a friend of mine has a Chromebook, and he booted it up, and it said damaged ROM, unable to boot. And we both kind of just sat there looking at it because you've never seen any. It's an older one, and he'd never, you know, it's old, and he bangs it around a lot. And then all of a sudden, it said repairing. And
how
after
do you repair
a while,
the ROM? Isn't ROM read only?
I immediately went to his router and started looking. There was a massive amount of traffic going to that thing.
Yeah.
There must be something in there that says I can't boot. Let me restore the ROM image from the internet.
Mm-hmm.
It reinstalled the ROM image
yep.
and rebooted itself. I know this because it took another hour to yep. download updates.
Apple does that too. With
holy
their...
moly!
Yeah.
They really did think of everything. Yep.
Apple added that a year or two ago in their laptops, which don't have optical drives again. They have an internet recovery mode.
Right.
It boots OS X over the internet. That yep. takes like half an hour.
Yeah.
And then it downloads a new OS X image, which is 4.5 gigs, so that takes all night.
Right.
And then reinstalls itself.
Unless you've got fiber to
unless
the
you've got fiber to the
think
home.
Think of anything. That's a commercial slogan in the making right there.
That's exactly yep. right.
They
all right. Another news item. We have nobody on the line at the moment. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Chromebooks have come out of, speaking of, have come from nowhere to grab nearly a fifth of U.S. school purchases of mobile computers, posing problems for Microsoft and possibly even Apple. The inexpensive laptops, which run Google software but are mostly sold by other companies, accounted for 19% of the K-12 market for mobile computers in the U.S. in 2013. In 2012, Chromebooks represented less than 1% of the market. Mobile computers running Windows slid from 47.5% of the market to 28%. Data from IDC that includes purchases to U.S. colleges and universities, as well as K-12, show a similar pattern, as well as signs of stagnation for Apple's iPad in the education market. While consumers and some businesses also are buying Chromebooks, analysts say schools and colleges are where the laptops have the biggest impact. In 2013, Chromebooks had an impressive year in the education segment, said Stephen Baker, an analyst at market research firm NPD. This year, Google needs to extend that success into other business segments where today they don't seem to have much presence. Chromebooks, introduced by Google and its hardware partners in 2011, are designed to run Google software delivered over the web rather than using programs installed on each system. The first model started at about $350, but prices on some newer Chromebooks have recently fallen below $200. Suppliers now include such U.S. companies as Dell and Hewlett-Packard, as well as Samsung, Acer, and other companies in Asia. Amazon's rankings for the best-selling laptops in the U.S. show Chromebooks in the top three slots. In fact, at Christmas, they held the top three slots and number five. While Chromebooks come with trade-offs, such as the need for an internet connection most of the time, the reduced reliance on downloaded software eases worries about computer viruses and other malware. Google has offered $2.7 million to anybody who can crack a Chromebook reliably and repeatably. While Chromebooks, for Microsoft, Chromebooks add to the already stiff competition that emerged after the iPad arrived in 2010. Microsoft's share of sales to schools and higher education, which hit 77% in 2010, has dwindled to 43% by the 2013 third quarter. The iPad has grabbed 10% of that market by early 2011 and 27% in the last year's third quarter, but that is a percentage point lower than the same period in 2012. Other data also point to slowing share gains. Apple's Mac computers, meantime, have seen their share of school and college purchasing fall to 15% in the first three quarters of 2013 from 17% in 2012. Chromebooks took 12% of that market by the third quarter. So what do you think of Chromebooks? Particularly versus the others. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. I have to admit, and I've said this many times before, I am in love with my Chromebook. I use it for everything. It's fast, it's convenient, it's easy. There are very few things I can't do on it. And I'm discovering more and more that there are either websites or apps that I can use to do those things. I just have to decide I want to do them and learn to do them that way. I'll tell you, it's kind of an amazing little device. I'm very pleased with it. The 4 gig ones obviously are a little faster. The higher end ones obviously a little faster. But I could live, if my eyes were better, I could live perfectly well with my old 11-inch 2-gig Chromebook. I still use it occasionally for various things, and it's fast enough and easy enough to use. It's just that the text is small for my old eyes. That's why I got a 14-inch Chromebook. There are new 13-inch ones from Lenovo and a couple of other companies that I'm looking forward to looking at. They'd be an interesting compromise between big enough to see and small enough to carry conveniently.
Yep.
13 seems to be the size Mac has gone with as well.
They still have the 11s and the 15s, but 13 is kind of the most popular size we see.
Yep. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. We're seeing them now with touch screens as well. We're going to take a quick break back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 40 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on the truly great and truly member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Richard from Rochester, New York on the line. Welcome, Richard. What's up?
Hi, Nick. Question has to do with USB ports.
Yes.
I have two ports on a Toshiba satellite. Has an i7 8.1 Windows. And about a week ago, it decided not to recognize an iPod and a hard drive backup.
Yep.
So I don't know if I've done something to cause this, but it could be a driver issue. I'm not really sure, but I thought I would give you a call, too. And I think I actually sent you an email on Ask Nick.
Well, you may have.
Yeah, but I know you're on the air, but
right.
What do you think? Is there a way to fix this if it's a driver's problem?
Well, two things. First, have you rebooted?
Yes, yeah, several times.
Okay, with the devices unplugged and then plugged them in?
I've done it. Well,
All right, try that if you haven't.
Yeah, I will do that. I know they work, and I know that when I plug in the iPod, as an example, not turned on, plug it into the USB port, and it powers itself, understanding that there's power coming to it.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, then the thing you want to do is in Windows.
Yeah. That would be in the control panel.
Device manager. And
device
delete.
Manager is yeah. where you want to be. So,
right click on my computer and choose manage.
Right. If you hit start, right, you bring up that list. Oh, you got Windows 8.1.
Yeah. So I'm looking. I get over in the control panel.
Yeah. Get over. No. Get over in the desktop.
I'm on the desktop. Okay.
It still has the start button. Yeah. No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Holy moly!
It has the. Going back and forth to the frame and then going back, you know, I can get to the pressing a tile, getting back to my desktop. I'm here.
Yeah, so
this computer. Oh, maybe this PC is right. So let me open that.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, sorry. And you want me to right click on it or?
Well, yeah. If you right click on it, you get a drop down menu.
All right, let me do that. I guess I've never recognized I had this computer there. How do you like that?
And okay. I did find how to get to it through control panel, too.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so I right-clicked, and it's open, manage, pin.
Manage.
Properties.
Right, you want manage.
Oh, so
we're trying to get into the device manager.
Yep, there you go.
Yeah. And then in that device manager that lists all the hardware things that the computer knows or that Windows knows about, you want to find the one that's your USB bus, or it may say universal serial bus.
Okay, on the computer. So it says device manager.
Yeah.
Right.
Click there. So here we go here. And universal at the bottom, universal bus controllers. Double click there, and a bunch of them are there.
Okay. Yeah, you want to remove
well,
them.
Well, hold on now. No. Are you seeing like a little yellow or red triangle?
No.
So it's. Probably working okay. We were thinking delete them and let Windows re-add them.
Right, but if you're not seeing any,
they're all listed. I mean, there's you know USB root hub, etc. The generic USB hub, Intel, there's
right. There's a whole bunch of them there.
A whole bunch of them, and none of them have any kind of markings other than to indicate that they're there.
Okay.
I bet there's an error.
Yeah, right. You're not seeing.
There's an error. You got a little yellow bag on it.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't see that. Right.
You could check the physical connections, the physical outlets on the computer to see if any of the pins are bent. We have seen that on some USB ports over time of things you plug and unplug a lot that you can accidentally bend the pins. So there's four pins in USB 2. And if one of them is power, so that could be why the iPod is still powering on. But if the data pins aren't working, then that could be why the computer is not recognizing there is USB.
Let me just I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. I think I do, and it's a matter of the pins that I'm looking at are in the connector,
right?
Not in the computer; it's in the connector.
Well, both. Check the ones in the computer. Yeah, and they're flat pins; they're not round
right.
pins.
I can see that now. They look in. I haven't even looked at that before.
Yeah,
I'll look closer. One other question. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but one other thing that I did find on the internet was this drive update. And there's a price to register it and have a year's, and that will update my drivers. But that may not be the issue. The issue may be physical.
Well, that's a service that looks at all the drivers in your computer and then goes and finds the updates.
Yeah,
you can do that yourself with Windows Update.
If you go into the device manager. One of the tabs should ask you if you want to check to make sure you have the latest drivers or update drivers or however they phrase that in 8.1. I can't remember.
But you have to do each device sort of manually with Windows. So these pay services will run a program that checks everything for you.
Yeah.
Convenience versus cost.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I can see that.
Now, you said you had two USB ports on the computer?
Say that again?
You had two USB ports on the computer?
Actually, I have a total of three.
And none of them work?
No. Here's what I think. I think they're all working, and here's how I test it. I do have another computer at home, and what I did was I brought the devices over
right.
to the other, and it pinged the, you know, how when an iPod or an iPhone or something connects and syncs, it pings.
Yep.
It pinged. But I wasn't able to update because that computer didn't have a particular file on it that it needed to update the iPod. So I know it's working.
But you're getting the USB chirp that it recognized the USB
exactly.
device.
Exactly. Yeah. So I know that. So it, and the other thing I do have is a mouse that has the a transmitter.
Right.
But I took the transmitter out and put it in the other USB ports, and it works. So my gut says, well, they're working.
So maybe it's a problem with the iPod.
It could be.
When you turn off your machine, are you putting it on standby hibernate, or are you actually turning it off?
I turn it off.
Okay, good. Yep. Good. What I would do if I were you is I would go down through the USB devices and make sure that you have the latest driver.
Right. Okay.
Run the little troubleshooter or whatever they call it on 8.1 and do that and see if that solves the issue.
And if it is an iPod issue, uninstalling iTunes and then reinstalling the latest version of iTunes is the usual fix for that.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. And there was a download recently, and who knows what that corrupted. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
right,
maybe.
Right.
Okay. Guys, thank you. I don't need to take any more of your time. You've answered all the questions. And, Nick, you can just reply by saying hi when you see the email.
All right, I will. Thank you.
Thanks again, guys. Appreciate it.
Yep, have fun.
Yep, bye-bye.
I have numerous email addresses and I tend to look at some of them only when I'm answering people's questions, like the one for the newspaper. I don't look at that every day. I look at that when I'm writing the column because I don't expect people to be. Oh well. Anyway, back to the phones. It's Gerd from Victor, New York. Welcome, Gerd. What's up?
Well, guys, I got a couple of questions. Number one, by the way, I am a paid-up member.
That's what I like to hear.
Yeah, and I have a Chromebook. Okay, here we go. Computer-generated passwords. What does that really mean? I mean, if I want a computer-generated password for my bank or my credit card, how do I know that I can even access that whatever it is.
Well, you have to, if the password has been generated by the computer,
yes.
You really want to do that in a product like LastPass or KeePass.
Right.
Because then it will be saved in LastPass or KeePass.
I understand.
And if you ever need to get it back, you can do that. It's essentially just means it's using a random number generator. Excuse me for all you nitpickers out there,
a pseudo random
number generator. We have several people who pick every nit they hear on the air. It's a pseudo random number generator, and it creates a pseudo random string of numbers, letters, and symbols as long as you want it to be.
And that's,
the theory being the longer it is, the harder it is to crack.
And that's often what the password generators will have a choice. Do you want it to be letters and numbers, numbers only, completely random? Do you want symbols in it too? Because some websites require certain things. I know the Apple ID password has to have one uppercase, one lowercase, and one number. So you can put that into your generator to make sure it gives you each of those. Some websites, and I hear this about some banking sites on the security podcasts, are numbers only, and they can't be more than 16 characters,
right?
Which means a really bad programmer at the other end.
Right.
And so you can limit how your random password is generated based on what the other end is requiring.
But how do I know that I'm getting, let's say, to my credit card or my bank or whatever?
When you go to that website and go to create an account or to change the password in your account,
right?
Your password manager program will offer to create a password for you.
Right. Here's what I think we're missing. The computer generates the password.
Right.
You still have to put it into the website.
Okay.
Whether you do that by copy and paste or by actually typing in it or whatever you want to do. So when your LastPass or KeePass says you can generate a password, it's really just making a series of numbers, just a string, which
right.
it will save. You then have to get that string into the login for the site you want.
And many of the password managers will paste that into the field. It knows it's a password field because it's reading the code behind that page.
But in fact, they're still two separate things. The computer generation in KeePass gets transferred to the website, but they're not linked in any way. Does that make sense?
No.
Okay, forget it then. I think we're not understanding your question.
Okay, I have a number of passwords to get into, let's say, my banking account or into my credit card account.
Right.
For me then to change it into a computer-generated password, how do I know that the bank's going to accept it or the credit card's going to accept it?
You tell your computer-generated password program what the limitations are. So if your bank says you can only use letters, then you create a password with only letters.
Right, and here are the steps you take, Gerd. You go into your, let's say, checking account.
Okay.
And you say, I want to change my password.
Okay.
It will ask you for your current password.
Okay.
It will then say, what's the new password?
Okay.
Now you go over to LastPass and tell it to generate a password and save it.
Okay.
You then take that password and plug it into the new password field on your web page, and then repeat that for the verified password. So really, they're two entirely separate things. You've linked them only by cutting and pasting.
Okay.
And so the bank doesn't know that you're using a password manager. It just sees you type 27 random characters.
Very quickly.
Okay.
So they're really completely separate things.
Can you put that on your to-do list thing there?
Yeah, on the website, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll probably take a little while. It's not something we're going to do right off.
No problem.
We have links to LastPass and KeePass programs that you can add. Apple just created their iCloud keychain service, so it syncs between your computers and your iDevices. So I just did what Nick was saying. I went to my bank, and I'm typing a new password, and Safari is suggesting a long, fairly random password for me.
Nice. We'll get something up shortly, maybe a password vault sort of thing.
Number two.
Yeah.
Chromebook.
Love mine.
So do I, but I have a problem with printing to my printer.
Yeah. That's on purpose. You don't want to print anymore. You don't need paper.
Yeah, but the paperless office. We've been working on that for 30 years.
I just bought two cases of paper.
You want to set up Google Cloud Print. Do you have another computer on your network somewhere?
I have three.
That the printer is connected to, yeah. So Google has a feature called Cloud Print.
Okay.
Many new printers have Cloud Print built into the hardware, as well as Apple's AirPrint technology that iOS devices use.
But mine is not a brand new one.
Right. So you install Google Cloud Print on one of your devices.
Okay.
One of your other computers.
Okay.
And then it will. My headphones just got weird. Yeah. Then everyone's did. Okay. So once you have Google Cloud Print installed on one of the computers, your Chromebook, you're going to print to your cloud printer.
Right.
It goes through the internet.
Right.
It goes down to your other computer and into the printer.
Hold on, Gerd. We have to go. Do you want to hang on or are we done?
I'm going to listen to you after you're done.
Perfect. We're going to take a break.
By the way,
No.
I am a paid-up member.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Gerd. We're gonna disappear for a short bit. We'll be back for a whole nother hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Thank you.
Back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Loden.
And at 2 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. All right, one of you decide who's going to turn his mic on and off. Because if you both do it, He's either going to always be on or always be off or whatever. Before we get back to the phones, let me just say that we will, this is for GERD, we will be putting up something about how to use computer-generated passwords and how to print with Google Cloud Print. I should set that up, even though I never use printing. I should set that up. Anyway, back to the phones. Our next caller is Joe from Brighton, New York. Welcome, Joe. What's up?
Hi. I kind of have a problem with sending out email through Thunderbird. When I input an email address, when I'm sending a mail, this thing brings up a suggested address, and then which I put in to the, and then it won't send it. And it turns out that what the Thunderbird is doing is it's bringing up the person's name plus the email address. And the Thunderbird says it won't send it because of syntax error. Is there any way I can get around this without trying to just erase the person's name from the outbox?
Well, first, if you do erase the person's name, does it send it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. And these suggestions that it's bringing up, where are they coming from? They're coming from your address book. I understand that.
It's just a server, and I'm not sure. I'm not that familiar with it. I don't know which server it's coming from.
Yeah, without looking at your... Well, it sounds like there's a configuration error somewhere.
Uh-huh.
But without looking at your machine, I can't tell you exactly where that error is. Oh, dear. I'm trying to think of how to diagnose this without seeing it.
Yeah.
That's an issue, and I don't know what to say about it. This machine needs to go to somebody who can actually see what's going on in the screen. It could be something as simple as an odd misconfiguration in Thunderbird. It could be that the syntax error actually has to do with you can send mail if you type in the thing by hand.
If I type the person's email address in by hand, it will send it. Yeah, but if it brings it out of the address book, it won't unless I erase the name that's in front of it, in front of the email address.
Yeah, I'm afraid somebody's got to look at that. I have no idea what the issue is there. I'm sorry, Joe.
Okay, thanks for your help, though.
You're going to have to take that to somebody who can deal with that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks again.
Thanks. I hate to tell people that, but sometimes the answer is somebody's got to be looking at it.
There you go. Yeah.
All right, thank you. Bye. I always feel like I failed when that happens, but there's nothing much you can do about it. It is what it is, you know?
Yeah, it is what it is.
But the Thunderbird generally just brings stuff up from the address book, and when it does, there isn't an issue because it works fine.
I'm gonna turn that one on.
Did he say that he tried deleting them from the address book?
No, we didn't talk about that. But if that would be the next step. But if they were, well, that's the other thing.
I've run into this program with Mac Mail. The address book and the previous recipient list are two separate lists, and if you type somebody's address wrong, it remembers it on the previous recipient list that you have to delete separately from your address book. I don't use Thunderbird enough to remember if it has that feature.
Well, the other problem is the error is not was no address or whatever it might be. What it was a syntax error, an actual syntax error. Which sounds like the address itself was incorrect in some way. So
yeah, maybe a comma instead of a period.
Yeah. Well, again, without seeing it, how do you know? So he's got to look at it. Anyway, back to the phones. Our next caller is George from Greece, New York. Welcome, George. What's up?
Good afternoon, fellas. Help me out. I need to have a better understanding of the cloud. And let me say, here's what I think I know about it from hearing about this for a couple of years. I thought it was a place to store essentially data or information of that type away from my computer.
Yeah.
But now I'm hearing about businesses investing in, for example, Microsoft is making a big push to get it further into the cloud. And so there must be more to it than what my my understanding has been.
Yeah. Well, you were actually right years ago. It was basically a place to store data. But now, with the resurgence, I guess, or the surgence of software as a service, SaaS, as they call it, SaaS, software as a service, you actually run programs from the internet. So you can run Microsoft's Office programs directly from the internet through your browser. You can run Google Docs directly through your browser. You can run Apple's
iWorks
through the browser. And that's still in the cloud because they use the word cloud for anything that's not on your computer nowadays.
It's fewer syllables than internet.
Right. Two fewer syllables, and therefore a better word. But nowadays, there is almost no real difference between the cloud and the internet, except perhaps the cloud kind of means somebody else's storage medium.
Yeah. And all the companies are building giant data centers filled with millions of hard drives. Well, the NSA just built one with, 13 yottabytes? So that's 13 million terabytes.
Yep.
Apple put a big one in North Carolina. Google's putting one in Utah, is it? So everyone is building giant, million square feet buildings filled with hard drives so that they can store files and have that processing power offline, off of your computer.
Right.
It's kind of the what we've seen in the past. What used to be called a thin client. So in the very olden days, you had a giant computer in your basement, and you were a company.
In your company, right.
And you had terminals on desks. And so that thing on your desk had no processing power. Everything was done on the giant computer in the basement.
It was basically just a monitor with a keyboard and a mouse.
Right. And then we started getting into mini computers and microcomputers. And then you actually got a physical computer on your desk. And then you might have a central hard drive for storing files. Mm-hmm. And now we're moving back to the other end where you have a thin client, they're being called, like a Chromebook, has very little processing power itself because all the processing is done on the internet, the giant computer in the basement of the internet.
Right.
Okay, I find that very helpful. Now let me go a step further. Then my data and the programs, the operating programs, are going to be located in the cloud.
Right.
First of all, so the cloud then is kind of split up into different people that own pieces of it, and I would deal with someone offering a cloud service.
Exactly.
Got that right?
Yep.
Now, that sets me to thinking then how they may have very exotic systems to make sure they're up and running and to protect against failure.
Right.
On the other hand, what we hear about is companies going out of business.
Yep.
What do they owe me? And how much advance time is typical for somebody who's running a cloud enterprise?
Well, they owe you nothing, and they don't have to tell you anything.
And I don't pay them anything?
And you don't pay them anything. However... Yeah,
right. Although there are some softwares as a service that you do pay for.
Right. However, some places, for example, Google, have a way for you to download all your stuff. Google, for example, has said, you own your stuff, we don't. Therefore, they have something they call the Data Liberation Front, where they have another name for it now as well, where you can download everything you've got in the Google Cloud. You can download all your documents, all your pictures, all your email, all your posts in Google Plus, everything. And you can do this as often as you want. And it'll zip them all up, and that could take several hours. So when you depending if you're like me and you're just wordy son of a gun, you start it running and you check send me an email when it's ready to download. and I get an email that says your data are ready to download. I hit the link, and it starts to download my megabyte-sized zip file.
So let me understand. I used to have my operating system on my desk, and I did the backup in the cloud. Now my operating system's in the cloud, and I back it up on my desk.
Exactly! Exactly, George! You got it! 100%!
Well, you guys have a great way of explaining things. I appreciate it. Oh, incidentally, then, I need to have a better browser than I'm probably using now for to do all of the things you talk about.
What are you using?
Well, I'm using Outlook.
Internet Explorer. Yeah, you need a better browser.
And is it so it's going to have features then that allow me to access features being offered by my cloud server?
HTML5 is the latest version of the web language that most of these fancier websites are using now.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that again?
HTML5, the hypertext markup language, yeah. So IE10 isn't bad.
Right.
Chrome, Firefox, Safari, most of a modern browser in its current version is usually fine.
So that then, from what you just described, that's part of what perhaps Microsoft is doing, is developing software that they're going to sell to me to make better and better use of what's offered in the cloud, whether by Microsoft or by someone else.
That's the whole purpose of the Chromebook, is you get to just use the cloud all the time.
Oh, okay.
Any of the other devices, you can use your browser to get to exactly the same places. So, for example, I have an ID. My Apple ID gets me iWorks if I want to write in Pages and Numbers and whatever the other one is called. If I want to, I can use my Microsoft login to go to Office 365, which I think they just renamed something else yesterday.
It used to be docs.com.
Right, and then now it's something else, and I forget what it's called now. Or I can use my Google interface to go to Google Drive and use Google Docs. And in fact, I use all three. Mostly, I almost always use Google.
And of those three big companies, it's unlikely that they would fail.
Right.
Although Google is known for killing products.
Right.
That we're sometimes, that we really like. Yeah. Oh, the Google graveyard is cute. But that goes back to the old mainframe days with the giant computer in the basement. You sat down at anybody's desk, logged into your username, and all of your stuff showed up.
Right.
Because it wasn't on that thing on the desk. It was in the giant computer in the basement.
Again, I use Google mainly because of the data liberation front. The ability for me to download all of my stuff in a format I could use anywhere else if I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen that yet as easy to do from Apple or Microsoft.
Now, there's one link here that I haven't heard you talk about, and that is the Internet access, which I find becoming exceedingly slow as I try to access information on Yahoo.
Because more and more people are using cloud services.
So,
right. Well, Yahoo is a separate.
I'm going to be slow getting in and out of the cloud.
Well, but that depends on where you go and how you're connected.
Okay.
Right? So, for example, if you're, let's say here in Rochester, you have three choices. You have DSL, which has a certain maximum speed. You have cable, which has a certain maximum speed. And Greenlight is bringing in fiber, which has a hugely massive maximum speed. So, depending on which of those you use, your end is fast. However, you're going through 50 connections to get to where you want to go, and how busy is that other end? I have found that Google, very, very fast. Microsoft and Apple, very, very fast. Yahoo, pretty slow. And that's Yahoo, not the rest of the internet.
That's what I was suspicious of.
Yeah.
Okay, I've had more than my share of time. Let me say I'm a subscriber.
Yay.
Every time I have a conversation, I know why.
There you go. Thank you, George.
Yep. Thank you.
And your internet speeds are greatly affected by other people in your neighborhood. Both DSL and cable are shared at slightly different points, but they're both a shared service. So we notice in our office at between 2 and 3, when all the kids get home from school and get on their Xboxes and PlayStations, our internet starts getting much slower.
Right.
Fiber internet doesn't have that big of an issue because it's so much faster to begin with.
Right.
But it is an issue the more people using it. And the companies are building faster and faster infrastructure. I just read an article that Time Warner is working on rolling out faster internet speeds. So right now Time Warner offers up to 50 megabit at a ridiculous price compared to other cities, and their DVR only does two channels at once. So they're saying they're coming out with faster speeds and a six channel DVR. They're rolling it out in New York City and LA first, and the rest of the country may take a couple of years. But that's what they said last January too. So right. it's been a year already, and it's still going to be a couple more years.
Right. DSL seems to be distance related as right. to how fast you can be.
And generally, we see DSL maxing out at like 10.
Right, and Greenlight Network seems to be the lowest speed is 50 megabits.
Yeah, and there's satellite available if you're in the outlying areas, which typically away from DSL or cable lengths, but satellite is often slower and more expensive.
Right,
but for some people that's their only option. So there was a study that got released about the fastest internet speeds, and. Some states, it seems like the smaller states on the East Coast had a faster average speed, partly because there's less rural areas in Vermont and Delaware. But the broadband.gov, the national broadband incentive, trying to get faster broadband to more people. In the cities, it's fine, but you get out into the rural areas, and we deal with a lot of customers in Ontario County, and between Victor and Canandaigua, there's almost nothing available,
right.
And you're stuck with, if you're lucky, DSL, and if you're too far away from the road, running cable TV to your house is prohibitively expensive,
right?
And so we still have a lot of people using satellite. Around the lakes because they just don't have any other infrastructure available.
Right. And we're seeing that continue throughout the country as there are. That's one of the reasons Google has the Loon project. But where they're putting up balloons to repeat things. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, Tim from Rochester is on the line. We'll be back with him. I'm Nick Francesco. It is 20 minutes after the hour. We're Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Soundbites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Before we go back to the phones, Joe in the Google Hangout has reminded me that the Data Liberation Front is now called Google Takeout. Thank you, Joe. And our next caller is Tim. From Rochester, New York. Welcome, Tim. What's up?
Yeah, hi, guys. The first off, the RevoUninstaller.com, or should I try to get it from the CNET? What's your opinion on what the best place to get it?
Well, RevoUninstaller.com is, in fact, the website for the
right
product.
They may...
not on.
I'm not on at all, am I?
No.
Nope.
Oh, I'm plugged in.
I can hear it rattling. Why are you not talking?
It's the spit shield isn't working right. So yeah. Maybe I have to gain. This mic has to be a higher gain. So I'll
yeah,
get,
it might be.
So, yeah, RevoUninstaller.com is the actual site. But sometimes these sites will send you to, like, CNET or Major Geeks to do the actual download so they don't have to host the file themselves.
Okay.
The problem we're seeing is that many of these third-party download sites will put their own wrapper around it. So you go to CNET and they'll download, say, the Ask Toolbar. So you have to make sure you uncheck all that extra stuff you don't necessarily want.
That's why I asked, because the last couple of times I've been to CNET, there's been something like that involved, and yeah. I was just looking for a cleaner way to do it.
Yeah. So yeah, always start with the actual publisher themselves and see where they send you to do the physical download.
Okay.
And when you're downloading something, Mac or Windows, make sure you read all of the options and check and uncheck the boxes that may give you stuff you didn't think you needed.
Okay.
Or didn't know you wanted.
Okay, my next question is, I've been dealing with a major hack on all of our sites, and I've used Site Doctor a bunch of times now. They can't seem to fix this. It's a total mess. So what we've decided we're going to do is just rebuild everything from scratch. We're also going to switch servers, start with brand new WordPress, and all that stuff. Have had really bad luck with Bluehost, by the way, but that aside, do you guys know anything about WordPress and have any opinions about site lock, for starters, and any other ways to protect WordPress?
What I would suggest you do? There is on Facebook, mm-hmm. There is a Rochester WordPress group.
Oh.
And they are some of the smartest people I know.
Great.
About WordPress. So check them out. I think you have to ask to join the group. I don't remember. I use the Rochester Google's group more often than that, but than the WordPress group. So I don't remember. But I would ask them specifically.
And one of the big things is keeping it up to date and keeping all your plugins updated.
Yeah, it's a pain in the neck.
Which is a pain in the neck. Yeah, every couple of days or so, that seems like there's another WordPress update. But we're using WordPress on the Soundbites website, the Apple Cider website, and because it's easy to use and free.
On that plugins note, is there a because I think all of our problems might have started with a plugin. Is there? How do you know if a plugin doesn't have some kind of code in it that's going to reroute your stuff or do whatever?
You don't know,
okay,
as the short answer, until you tear apart the plugin yourself check what it does.
And so the thing to do is Google that plugin name and see if it's got a good or bad reputation, because someone probably has already figured out if there's a problem with it.
Okay.
And most of the plugin websites, don't they give you a rating to...
so you can see what the reviews are and that stuff, too.
Okay. Then just, do you guys have any opinion on the SiteLock service? And then my last question would be, making my new sites in HTML5, if there's any advantages? And that's my last question.
Okay, two things. I don't know a lot about SiteLock.
Okay.
I would ask the group, the WordPress group.
Okay.
As for HTML5, it is the future. It is the way everybody's going. The more HTML5 you can use, the better off you are.
Can everyone see it?
Right now, yes, unless they're still using IE7. Oh, and
an
if they
ancient
are,
browser.
The heck with them.
And definitely do not use Flash.
Do not use Flash.
It's power hungry and CPU hungry and doesn't work on mobile devices.
Oh, and Google can't...
Index it
so you don't. So it's.
I hate websites that are one giant Flash page.
Right. Gotcha.
Because Flash was the big thing 10 years ago.
Right.
15 years ago, but now it's HTML5.
Okay. Okay. This is terrific. Thanks so much for your time.
Good luck.
Okay. Yep. Thanks. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
That reminds me of the XKCD comic about the Tornado Guard. It's got a 4-star review. Great alert choices. You know, it doesn't crash. Oh, I can set multiple locations. And the 1-star review is didn't warn me about the tornado.
Yeah.
But it gets an average of 4.
Right. Because all the things that are unimportant.
Yeah.
All right. Our next caller is Dave from Canandaigua, New York. Welcome, Dave. What's up?
Well, got the worst cold I've ever had, but I'm getting by.
Sorry.
I've got a camera, a D-Link camera that I bought.
Yeah.
And
webcam?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's I hooked it up to my network and all, and with Windows, fire up my browser, I can log into the camera and see the image. So the next step is where I'm ultimately going to put this camera is in the dark in the basement. So sitting at my computer, it's a little hard to aim the camera. All right, so my next trick was let's take the iPad and connect to the camera through my network. And I can actually put the IP address of the camera in Safari, but it won't display the image.
What format is the camera outputting?
Well, it's either the MPEG or the H.264. I can do either one, but it won't display the image in Safari.
You often need a special URL that the camera software should tell you to display that MPEG stream. It may not be an HTML page that it's trying to load. So I do that with the cameras that I run. So it might be the IP address and then slash, you know, MPEG or video.mpg.
Or :8080.
Well, yeah, you need to know what port number it's broadcasting on.
Okay.
And oftentimes what camera number it is, because sometimes you can have several cameras.
So when you grabbed the IP address, did you simply copy the address, the URL bar from your Windows machine, or did you get the address some other way?
Well, I had to punch it in through the little keyboard that pops up.
Yeah, but where did you get it?
Well, it's the default address that
okay.
the camera uses.
All right, so what you want to do is go back to your Windows machine that's working
right,
and take a look at what's actually in the address bar.
Right.
It may be more than just the address.
And you also may need to check the manual of that camera to see if the HTML stream or the MPEG stream is a different URL yet.
I'll check into that. See, the other part of this was I went to the App Store, and the app which D-Link makes, it's called My D-Link Lite. I downloaded that because that's supposed to allow me to access the camera.
Right.
But it doesn't show up on my desktop or whatever you call it on an iPad. It's according to when I'm in the App Store, it's been downloaded, but it will not show up on the iPad itself.
And you've looked at all the screens?
Yeah. How many? If you have too many apps on the iPad, it may have fallen off the edge of the apps. So if you go to the search option, you can search for an app by name.
Okay.
So if it says it's downloaded, it's on there somewhere. It just may be hidden that you can't see it if there's too many apps.
I don't have that many apps. I've only got the one original page plus one and then another half a page.
So it's just,
search for it anyway and see if, and that'll tell you if it's there.
Where do I search? How do I search for that?
Are you running OS 6 or OS 7?
7, I think.
In OS 7, you swipe down on any page. And that will bring up the search iPad window at the top of the screen.
So it does, yep. Okay, I'll give it a shot.
All right, good luck.
Like, so on my camera that I just opened, hi, Tyler and Chris, if you're listening to the show, and the customer who's...
And why wouldn't they be?
And why wouldn't they? But yeah, they're talking to the customer. So I have to put in my camera's IP address, my camera's port number, and then /1, because it's camera 1, /stream.html. So I can't put just the IP address. I have to put the rest of that URL in so I can see that camera.
All right, our next caller, Henry from Brighton, New York. Welcome, Henry. What's up?
Hi. I'd like to follow up on the question that was asked earlier about Windows 8 or 8.1.
Sure.
I'm giving some advice to a friend of mine who wants to upgrade his old XP machine, or wants to get rid of it, actually, buy a new machine to run the latest OS. The question is, should he, I'm trying to advise him whether or not he should get Windows 8 or 8.1 or Windows 7. Now, earlier you seemed to be saying that Windows 8.1 did not offer the equivalent of the Windows 7 desktop look.
It does, but it's not the default.
That's okay. I mean, he can go to, he can, you know, set it up so that he's running the Windows 7.
Right. So Right. So right now, here's the way it works. If you have Windows 8.1, when you boot it up, you're in what's called the modern interface with all those little tiles.
Yeah.
There's something at the lower left-hand corner that lets you get to the desktop.
Okay.
In Windows 8.1 Update 1, which is coming out shortly...
Which we used to would have called Service Pack 2.
Right. Service Pack 2. We will be able to pick... whether the modern interface, the tiles, or the desktop is your default.
The default, okay.
And that theoretically
happen before April, right?
That's
before,
theoretically, yeah. Sometime within this quarter.
Okay.
Theoretically.
Yeah. So wouldn't it then be advisable, just from the standpoint of the extent to which Microsoft will support Windows 8 versus Windows 7, to advise them to get Windows 8 or 8.1?
My advice is always get the latest.
Get the latest, okay.
In this case, that's tempered by, can you live with that one extra click until the choice becomes available?
Right, I think you can handle that. Right. As we all do, we all hate that new interface, the Metro interface. So.
Yeah,
and some people do like it, but yeah, it's, the change is what people don't like.
Yeah. One thing I'm also puzzled about, you say that some laptops or even desktops might have a touch capability at this point.
Yep.
But even if you do, it's kind of awkward, I think, to lift your hand up and touch a vertical surface and point to, especially on a laptop where the lid tends to move as you press on it. It gives way, so you don't really want to use a touch.
Well, not as touch only, but it's sometimes a nice addition to the keyboard. And I find myself, and I hear this a lot too, after using my iPad for a while, to touch on things and tap buttons, I'll do that on my desktop. And, oh, crap, I can't do that.
Right. You're right. I find a lot of people doing two-handed stuff where they grab the screen and then they tap and then they go back to the keyboard and grab the screen and tap.
And I've sort of developed a two-handed feel over the years. My right hand is on my mouse and my left hand is on the keyboard. So I do all my typing with only my left hand and keep my other hand on the mouse. I don't use my trackpad much on the laptop. I find my fingertip gets numb from using it. So I still like to use a physical mouse.
The touch mode makes sense for an iPad or any tablet lying flat.
Right.
But not for a screen that's pointing up.
Well, and we saw that a while ago when they first started touting, they were going to bring the Minority Report interface to the laptops. We discovered that people don't have the muscles to keep their hands up in front of the screen like that for hours at a time.
Steve Jobs called it gorilla arms when he was saying we weren't going to add it to the Mac.
Well, I used to be a puppeteer many years ago. And let me tell you that you will find new muscles after your first few hours of rehearsal with your hands way up over your head. Also, you will discover that you can, in fact, lose sensation down to the elbow.
It's hard work.
It's hard work. Puppeteering is danged hard work, let me tell you. But you have to develop new muscles to use it. And most people aren't going to want to do that. You do it when you're a puppeteer because it's the only way you're going to get paid. But for most people, they're not going to do that. They're not interested in that. I agree with you.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for the tips.
Thanks so much, Henry.
Bye.
And most people are envisioning in a world, eventually all computers will be touchscreen, but probably still have a keyboard option. But we see in science fiction, all computers go voice control, and we're seeing that now with Siri and Google Now and dictation built into computers. But it doesn't work. Like Nick and I, we couldn't be talking to our computers now. Or you're in an office cubicle environment, and the guy next to you says, computer, erase hard drive.
We're going to take a break? Okay, no. Let me tell you the best thing I ever see, which is it used to be students would, we would take a break in class, the class would be over. They'd stand up. Invariably, some student would take out his iPhone and hit Siri, and you'd hear that distinctive ding noise. Two or three people would yell, call mom.
Yeah.
The next thing you know, this poor kid's explaining, no, mom. Yeah, I love you, mom. No, I just wanted to. I didn't mean to. I did mean to call.
Well, see, now that Google Now is always listening, a lot of the new phones, it's always listening. You say, okay, Google, and then call mom. And okay, so everyone who has a Google phone on the air just now.
right.
Okay, Google.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden. We'll have Jack from Rochester on the line, Mina Francesco, and you. It's 40 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Jack from Rochester, New York on the line. Welcome, Jack. What's up? Jack, you there? Hello, Jack. Jack.
Hello?
No, there
there you go.
Well, I'm not Jack. I'm Jim. But
sorry, Jim.
A couple of things. The fellow is having trouble with Thunderbird.
Yeah.
All he needs to do is go. It has an address book. Go into the address book. It's on the menu at the top. And delete that entry and just put it in again. He knows the name and the address, so it'll be fine after that.
Right. Well, he seems to say it's something to try, but he says it's happening with all of them.
So maybe the whole address book is corrupted.
Yeah, so it sounds like the whole address book is a problem.
It's corrupt. Yeah. So he's toast.
Yep.
I had a question about, I have a computer with an SSD that I want to sell, and the manufacturer has, you know, the OS on it if I want for recovery. I want to reformat everything and sell it because I want to get rid of all my stuff. How do I do that without wasting what they have on there?
Well, the theory is they're two separate partitions.
Okay.
So if you only nuke your partition,
yeah,
that should do it.
And then run the recovery from that second partition. In fact, that probably has an erase option. There is a program called Derek's Bootin' Nuke, dban.org, that will completely erase a hard drive, but I don't know if you can pick a single partition. But if you boot that recovery partition, one of its options should be to format the partition you're reinstalling the OS back onto.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
In fact, sometimes that's the only option. I just want to reinstall Windows. I don't want to erase and reinstall everything, and too bad. You know, we know better. So often that is an option in those recovery partitions. You can reinstall just Windows, or you can erase the partition and reinstall everything as if it was just purchased from the factory.
Okay. Well, I'll just start running it and see what they give me.
Yep.
Right.
All right, great. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
There you go. Thanks. I really like Derek's Bootin' Nuke. Good product.
Yep.
Well done. Well done thing. And it is, you just create the CD, boot it up, throw it in, and you decide how secure you want to be.
Honey Oi,
look at the falls.
I'm sorry, what was the name?
Jeff.
Jeff from Honey Eye Falls, Jeff.
No, just Honey Eye. No falls over here, just the lake.
All right.
Honey, oi, look at the lake.
I just had just a quick question. I'm trying to get a firewall set up around my system. I'm kind of new to everything. I got everything at Lowe's to build around the machine itself, so there's, you know, if it did catch on fire, that, it couldn't spread. But outside of that, you know, I'm not exactly sure in terms of insulation to prevent, too much heat from a... Hello?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Here's what I would do. I would build a large brick enclosure and then surround that with another large brick enclosure and put fire suppressant foam between the two.
All right, and that will prevent... That's not just for fire, right? That's also for hackers, for... And I did hear...
No, I would then mix into the...
The spying law act that Obama's trying to pass, the Monsanto law?
No, you now need two more things. You need, first, for that fire suppressant foam, you need to mix in a whole lot of Purell. And that'll help with the viruses. And then just snip the Ethernet cord, and that'll prevent anybody else from getting in. So you're good to go.
All right. So, and the Purell, now, that'll help, so no one's going to know what porn I'm watching, right?
That's exactly right. In fact, you won't even know what porn you're watching.
Because I'm not saying it's anything illegal, but, it'll be embarrassing if, everyone finds out.
And you've only mentioned it now on radio, so...
What was that?
And you've only just mentioned it on radio, so no one will know.
There's plenty of guys in Hungary that are watching porn. Believe me,
all of them.
Not much
Jeff.
Going on out here.
Yeah. All right, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for the laugh.
All right, thanks, man.
There was actually a thing I've been reading online is that the British government is mandating that all of the ISPs block porn in Britain. And so the ACLU type agencies over there are all getting up in arms. There's a
bird from where?
There's a provision that you can call your ISP and ask for porn to be turned back on, but you know that's annoying. And
that would be really annoying.
And what do they count as porn? Because I still remember that ages ago here, there was a company that was putting out a family-friendly ISP, so they blocked stuff at the ISP. They blocked wrestling as porn.
Yeah.
And people would call the show and were mad. Why are they blocking wrestling? That's fine. Well, it's half naked men jumping on each other. Oh, and you know, women.
AOL got into trouble. They tried to make it family friendly, and they blocked the word breast, which meant the breast cancer survivor group suddenly was kicked off AOL. That made them a little angry.
And then it came out that one of the porn filters that the ISPs are using is made by Huawei, which is a Chinese company. Owned and run by the Chinese military.
Right.
So, okay, that doesn't make it any better either.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Bert from Palmyra, New York. Welcome, Bert. What's up?
Hello. Great show as always, guys.
Thank you.
You've talked about SSDs before. I was just wondering if any of you read Linux Journal by any chance?
I do, but I'm woefully far behind. Why?
January of this year's issue. Great article on them.
Excellent. I will check that out. Thanks.
Okie doke.
Yep, we're seeing.
I just also wanted to mention my wife's computer runs on Windows 8.
I'm sorry.
She got a notification today to upgrade to 8.1.
Yeah, she wants to upgrade to 8.1, and then shortly there will be 8.1 update 1.
Right.
Which will make it easier to use that option.
Yeah. Okie doke. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Bert. You too.
What journal was that? Did you say
the Linux Journal?
Linux World or Linux Journal?
Linux Journal.
Linux Journal. Okay, because I want to post that link. But we've been seeing SSDs getting cheaper and faster and bigger, but still a terabyte SSD is pushing close to $1,000.
Right.
If you want the full speed versions. So until and it's one thing that Apple's been doing is they have something called the Fusion Drive. It's part SSD for speed and part mechanical drive for capacity.
Right. All right, our next caller, Sam from West Henrietta, New York. Welcome, Sam. What's up?
Hi, guys. Great show.
Thank you.
Nick, I read your column a couple weeks ago about Windows 7 being obsolete.
Yes.
And any updates, including security updates, will be by April 8th? What does that mean to me?
Well, I got
Windows 7.
That's Windows XP.
That's Windows XP.
And they extended that till July 2015.
Right.
So they extended it again. They'll still support Windows XP with updates.
What happened is this. Microsoft, when they put out new operating systems, announced an end of life for the old operating system at the point past which they will not support it.
And it's usually a year after the new one comes out.
Right. Windows XP is, 10 years old now?
Yeah.
And they finally decided enough is enough. We're tired of spending time, money, and effort on a 10-year-old operating system. Well, duh. So they said, we're done. And everybody went insane because many people these days, particularly in these parlous economic times, are still running 10-year-old computers, which will run XP fine and won't run Windows 7 well at all, or 8 at all. So Microsoft backed down, bowed to pressure, and said, all right, we'll definitely continue at least for another year. But seriously, folks, genuinely, get rid of those old machines.
No, I have 7. I don't have XP.
Good.
Yep. Okay. So the Windows 7 life cycle... let's see, Windows 7, what's the one that most people have at home? Home Premium? Service Pack, that can't be right. April 2013.
Yeah, that could be right. Absolutely, that could be right.
So that's Service Pack ended. Extended support for Windows 7 ends January 2020. So Windows 7, we have a few more years yet. And mainstream support ends January 2015. And under notes, Microsoft says, buy Windows 8 now. So eventually that they'll stop supporting Windows 8 as they're pushing, or as stop supporting Windows 7 because Windows 9 will be out by then. But we'll probably see them extend that life cycle support as well. Although Vista, they didn't extend.
Now, that says 2015 because this Microsoft page says 2014. April 8th, 2014.
Is that XP or 7?
Well, they didn't extend XP. Vista because because the great majority of the people that had Vista either got rid of Vista.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they don't really have any reason to extend it.
So here's the deal, though. That's the end of extended support. Mainstream support ended in 2009. Ended 5 years ago.
So no bug patches other than critical security patches.
Right. That's what extended support means. Critical security patches only for XP. Windows 7, mainstream support ends January 13th, 2015.
Uh-huh.
And extended support is another 5 years.
Okay.
So if you're running Windows 7, you've got a year of mainstream support. That is to say, bug fixes, everything else. But by the end of that time, if you want to be fully secure, you want to run Windows 8.
Or 9, or maybe even 10 by
maybe
then.
Maybe 9 or 10 or 15 or whatever number they
got. Then what is McAfee? I have McAfee security, too. What does that mean?
McAfee is an entirely different product from an entirely different company and runs under an entirely different set of schedules.
And generally, that's once a year. You subscribe to a year of updates, and every year they release a new program as well.
Right. And when I'm talking about Windows XP mainstream support, I'm not just talking about security. I'm talking about bugs in the program. So if they find that there's a bad bit of logic somewhere in the thing that saves your files, they will fix that if it's under mainstream support. They will no longer fix that if mainstream support has ended.
Gotcha.
And we're done. Okay. Thank you so much. I want to apologize to everybody who's still on the line. You got to call earlier, folks. And we want to thank everybody who did call in. We're done for another week. I want to remind you, don't go away, because George is coming in to play the best German music you'll hear all week. Poor Michael, who had to wrangle us for 2 hours.
Yep.
Yeah. Now has to do the same for George. We'll be back next week with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 55 minutes after the hour. You've been listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, some weeks longer than others, Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you next week.